And one of the first things he said is, you know, your book is on my shelf, which I thought was wonderful because, you know, he obviously hadn't read it, but he didn't want me to think he had forgotten about it or something. And he was too honest to say anything else, but it was just very sweet.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Lord of America!
Life is a very rich thing, and for anybody that is just involved in UFOs, God help you. You will go insane. You will lose your mind. It's very important to be able to bounce off your own walls and, you know, have a good time and have fun.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Before we kick off the episode, let's plug our good buddy here, Pete Diggins, for providing the theme music for this installment of the program. You can find out more from Pete Diggins at www.aurophonic.com, AuroPhonic.com. Check it out. I've gotten a ton of submissions from folks out there who want to have their music featured on the program, and now that we have taken care of a lot of the in-house stuff, I will be able to give a closer listen to their music. But if you want to send something in the interim, shoot me a line at boaaudio@hotmail.com, and I'd be happy to tune in to your tunes. I kind of alluded to it there, but let's make it official and short and sweet. The big audio migration over to Cyber Ears is complete. Our iTunes feed is fixed. The MP3 and streaming audio links at BOA are fully functional once again. So hopefully all the folks who lost us over the last few months are picking us back up again and catching up on all the episodes they may have missed the last few weeks. Welcome back, my friends. The show continues onward. Speaking of which, let's get down to business on this week's installment of BOA Audio. Our guest this week is my good friend and one of ufology's great thinkers, the amazing Peter Robbins. He's been on the program numerous times, and since I've known Peter for quite a while, he was really one of the guys who inspired me to keep going and digging into the paranormal. I pretty much went into this throwing the questions out the window and setting aside some time to talk to Peter and just seeing where the conversation went. As such, it's a little tough to really pinpoint the areas that we talk about, but I'm going to do my best here. We're going to touch on Rendlesham, of course, and the big Rendlesham 30th anniversary that happened back in December of 2010. We'll get into the malaise of ufology that has become a running theme here on the program over the last few months. Peter's going to weigh in on that and how he combats the fatigue of trying to study this enigma. We'll talk about 2012, the mainstream media, and how they portray ETs and UFOs, and just the problems with the mainstream media in general. UFO skeptics, the alleged rapture event of May 21st, 2011, and what it says about society as a whole. We'll get reflective on a number of issues, get really meta in talking about what it's like being UFO researchers and how that changes your perspective on the world at large, and a whole bunch of big picture issues like what might be behind the UFO phenomenon and how difficult it is to really wrap your arms around that mystery. Altogether, really, it is a fast and loose conversation with someone I consider a very good friend in not just the world of the paranormal, but life in general. And as such, really, it is a fly-by-the-seat-of-our-pants conversation that just goes wherever it wants to go, and I think folks are really going to dig it. The incomparable Peter Robbins joins us here for a jam session covering the world of UFOs and so much more. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Peter Robbins, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Peter Robbins has been involved in UFO studies for more than 25 years. As a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author, he is a board member of Bud Hopkins Intruders Foundation and is co-author of the British bestseller Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Bentwaters-Woodbridge UFO incident, its cover-up, and investigation. Robbins has extensively lectured both in the United States and abroad, including dozens of talks throughout the United Kingdom. Venues have included local, national, and international conferences, as well as presentations for organizations, seminars, private groups, public, private, and secondary schools, universities, libraries, and scientific organizations, educational foundations, and Cambridge Hospital in Boston, under the sponsorship of the late Pulitzer Prize winner, Dr. John Mack. Peters also served as art director and investigator for the New York City-based Scientific Bureau of Investigation, SBI, a national police and civilian UFO research organization, and as editorial assistant on the requested Blue Memorandum for Parliament's House of Lords debate on UFOs in January of 1980, and served as research assistant on the United Nations Secretary General's report for the establishment of a UN UFO department. Unfortunately, Peter does not have a website that we can plug here, but he is on Facebook, so head on over to Facebook, punch in Peter Robbins, so you can befriend him or get in touch with him or follow his work. With all that said, let's kick back, relax, and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on June 1st, 2011. Peter Robbins joins us for a ufological jam session on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. And last year when I brought our guest back on the program in January of 2010, it was about 5 years since his previous appearance, and I promised him it wouldn't be another 5 years since he came back on the show. He's one of my very good friends. He's one of ufology's truly great thinkers and someone I enjoy talking to and really pondering this mystery with. And he's overall really a genuinely great guy, one of the most well-thought-of people in the world of ufology. Everybody seems to love this guy and has just amazingly kind words to say about him. I spent an enormous amount of time with him in person, hanging out in a variety of different venues, and you know, I can't put him over enough. I consider him a great friend, a mentor, someone who I turn to for advice, not just on matters UFO-related, but also life in general. Of course, he's the co-author of Left at East Gate with Larry Warren, and, you know, I could go on and on with the platitudes, but I want to actually start talking to him now. So welcome back to the show, Peter Robbins. It's going to be awesome.
Hi, Tim. And, yeah, the reason I'm so well-liked is I pay people to like me, and it works out. It is good to be back. It feels like it's only been 4 years.
Oh, man. Well, you know, we last chatted towards, I think, the middle of the summer, last summer, just for a little pop-in, but we had you on at length last January. Yes. So what have you been up to, you know, in the last 18 months or so?
Last year, major focus was the big events in Roswell. They always have 4 days in the beginning of July to coincide with the anniversary of the famous events of 1947. And for the past 3 or 4 years, I've worked for the city as a consultant and a coordinator of their symposium, and then moved on to, you know, some other small speaking dates. I picked up a column in the United Kingdom, and as of this past issue of UFO Matrix, they've been in business for a year, which is a great watermark,
yeah.
I think, along with Open Minds. They're really the two best English language magazines right now on the subject. And the column is called On Assignment. It's a bi-monthly. And I believe it's now available in Barnes & Noble stores around the country.
Nice, nice.
Yeah. Otherwise, this past December and into January brought me back to Suffolk, England.
Mm-hmm.
Because late December, between Christmas and New Year's, was the actual 30th anniversary of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. And there was a small conference that took place on the exact 30th anniversary of the Third Night's events, the ones that my co-author Larry Warren was involved in. And it was an extremely memorable, quite emotional, very unique conference. And this year, it's a lot of writing, but in March, there was a conference in Lawrence, Kansas that may stand as a one-of-a-kind conference. Mm-hmm. It was organized by two guys there who put up their own money and brought in 13 or 14 and some of the best-known names in UFO studies, and it was billed as the Reykjavik UFO Summit.
Okay, yeah, and, the name does ring a bell, yeah.
Yeah, and although, you know, the attendance wasn't huge, there was about 600 people in and out over the weekend, and it was great seeing a number of those folks again. And now, of course, you know, gearing up a bit long range for the upcoming Exeter Conference in September that we've been a part of the last few years, and that will be September 3rd, which is a Saturday. And although it's still coming together, we know that the main presenter is going to be Kathy Martin. And for anyone who, of course, follows this subject who has never heard Kathleen Martin speak, she is really a force in nature as far as I'm concerned. She's one of the greatest assets we have in that, you know, she seems fairly quiet and sedate, and she's a nice grandmother with a background in social work and education. But she also happens to be Betty and Barney Hill's niece, and arguably was the closest person to Betty for the whole latter part of her life relative to this subject. And her presentations are extraordinary, and as many of our listeners know, this September, coordinated literally just a few short weeks away from the actual Exeter Conference, it will be the 50th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. So that is one not to miss, and we understand, you and I, that there may be some other surprises, really big names involved.
Mm-hmm.
The program is not locked down yet, but I think that this will be the third annual one, and I think that they're building something really important there.
Yeah, it's going to be quite a good time, so folks should definitely check that out. One of the things you just said that really piqued my interest here was you're saying you were – Bentwaters for the 30th anniversary, and you had a big conference there, and you said it was emotional. You know, where's that coming from?
Yeah, it's not a term we usually use for, you know, UFO studies or a conference, but this was one of a kind. Anybody that's followed this extraordinarily important UFO incident, far and away the best known and best documented UFO incident in the history of the United Kingdom, certainly knows my co-author's name, Larry Warren. Larry was, at the time, an airman first class with a secret security clearance and a member of the United States Air Force Security Police, and was involved as an eyewitness in the third night's events. But other names have now, over the past years, started to you know, come into the public mindset, two of which are John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, who were involved earlier on. And my friend and colleague Linda Howe, although she's best known for her animal mutilations work, Crop Circle, and other things, she has done some terrific research on this case, and for the last few years has been working in great part with with John Burroughs, and more recently with Jim Peniston as well, although I don't know if they still are. She even did a very extensive interview with Larry Warren the year before we started working together, 1986, which is posted in several parts on her Earth Files website. But she and I and Jim and John were the speakers at this conference, and it was held in Woodbridge, Suffolk. Woodbridge is the nearest town, maybe less than a dozen miles from the sites of the events. And Larry was there basically to just say hi. He very generously deferred when we were asked to speak and said, you know, people in the UK who follow this are overall fairly familiar with my account because of our book and a lot of time on television, and many of them are not familiar with Jim and John's account, and I thought it took a lot of class. But he basically, we basically bowed out as keynotes, Larry in particular, and Jim and John kind of dominated the night. And Jim and John were involved on the first night, and both of them, even more than Larry, I realize now, the disturbances that they are still living with, the post-traumatic stress, in some cases, the knowledge that memories from that event that John in particular, but certainly Jim as well, are not sure about which memories are absolutely real or were implanted by American intelligence, not, you know, these other intelligences.
Yeah.
And the audience, we kept resetting the chairs that after, well, the day before to maximize the community center. And every time we did, I'd take a count and, you know, measure and just pushing the fire eggs to the max.
Yeah.
Got about 380 chairs in there, but we did have over 400 people. And the thing about it, Tim, was I'd say a good solid three quarters of them were local. And this was the story they grew up with. Some of them were kids at the time, other ones now, you know, certainly seniors. There was quite a handful of local witnesses, of retired British military, of English witnesses overall. And the other quarter of the audience came in from all over the place. But these people knew most of them knew every aspect of the story as well as it had been published, and they were angry. They were still angry at the British for lying about it. They were certainly still angry at the Americans for covering it up, and they were angry that they weren't getting some of the straight answers that they would have really preferred. In fact, I'm not saying any punches were thrown, but it's the first UFO conference I ever spoke at where a bunch of fights broke out in the audience.
Like arguments?
And it was basically, you know, a speaker would say something, and somebody would yell something like, no, that's a blip up, and the other person would correct them, and then they'd get into a thing. So it wasn't, you know, a soccer match, but they were emotional. And Jim and John were emotional. Jim told me at one point that night, the first night when he and John were out there in the forest, and, you know, there was this machine that he made the famous notes on, copied out the markings on it, touched it. It was the worst night of his life. All of these guys have burned through marriages, have health problems. Jim and John, and I'm talking out of school here, they are both seeing therapists. They have both been, I think, very forthcoming in allowing parts of video of their sessions, their hypnotic regression sessions with their therapists, to be used in coordination with some of the talks that they've done with Linda. And it was very moving and alternately frustrating, enraging that these guys were put through this, fascinating. And I'll tell you, I'll give you an example. At one point, John Burroughs was on stage. You know, he's a tall guy. He's got to be like 6'5", 6'6".
Yeah.
But he just looks kind of haunted, and he's the first one to say, you know, he's just never been the same since this. Question. John, is it true that when you came upon the machine in the woods, you drew your service weapon on it, went into a two-handed stance, and then reholstered it? John, I may have. I'm not sure. I don't know if it was a real memory or not. John, is it true, as I've heard, that you impulsively threw yourself on the thing? And it took off and went like 30 feet with you on it. I may have, but I may not have. I don't know whether it's a real memory or one they put in my head. John, were you abducted? I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. It was intense. And with the exception of a break, you know, I started it out with an under an hour presentation. Linda got up there, did her usually professional thing. Then Jim and John got up there, and then Nick came up, and we took a lot of questions. And after more than 5 hours, you know, we were emotionally tired. We were tired. They were working on a documentary at the same time. Jim or John said, we know you're all pretty beat. It's, you know, like 20 after 11 now. And this is a ferociously rough winter in England. Said, we know that we put on the website that if any of you were interested after the conference, we would take you out to East Gate, the East Gate of Woodbridge, where we were when it all happened, and try to recreate it for you. But we realize it's late, etc. Anybody still interested in going? And about half the hands in the room went up. Again, like close to 11:30. And I'd say about 40 minutes later, at least 150 people were pulling themselves together at the pre-appointed place in the forest. All of us who came were prepared, you know, two pairs of socks, flashlights, all that stuff. And we walked a half mile or so up East Gate Road with John and Jim and the Larry, other people, Brenda Butler, a famous local researcher, a whole bunch of folks, right back to where it all started. And a film team from, I think, the History or Discovery Channel. I forget which one's working on this thing. And they spent half hour, 40 minutes or so, recreating it for us. And it was intense. I mean, I've been out there more times than I can think over the past 23 years, at night, during the day, in the winter, the summer, but not like that. And so, yeah, it was a heck of a conference. And for any of us that felt, I mean, forget about the word closure, but that it might, you know, sew up some loose ends and things, we all left there just more fascinated, frustrated, curious, tired, you know, pissed off than we were before. In this case, as Larry once said, you know, this one's never going to go away.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to be heading back to Suffolk in a couple of months for another conference, but I don't think I'll ever be able to let this one go for the rest of my life. It is just part of my DNA right now, and, you know, spend that much time focusing in on one event and its ramifications on the lives of human beings, and, you know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting case, too, because it's, you know, they call it the British Roswell, but it happened so recently that we can really see the fallout much
clearer.
Well,
you're right, Tim. And again, the name, the British Roswell, is a good enough term based on the fact that it's as famous there as Roswell is here. Not that Roswell isn't famous there as well, but that's about where it stops. And you're right, not only is it more contemporary, but, you know, the last of the old guard of the anybody associated with the Roswell events are coming into the home stretch, where literally everybody that was involved in this incident, I'm sure with a small number of exceptions, is alive, hopefully well. And if our elected officials ever had the courage to look into this again in congressional investigation, you know, that ain't going to happen with this group of jerks. this would be the case. This would be the one that could bust it open. All the more reason that they're not going to want to even take a look at it. But it is fascinating. It continues to be the subject of declassified material, although the big story relative to it in March was a BBC story from, I think, March 3rd, saying that Her Majesty's government had declassified and posted, I don't know, another 8 or 10,000 pages of mid-level UFO documents on Ministry of Defense website. But the big story was that all of the documents relating to Rendlesham were missing. And the next day, on March 4th, the New York Times, true to form, published an article where they tried to mock it. It was a little difficult, but they took some shots at it and, you know, used the silly kind of terminology that they do. Had a very interesting photograph that they even had there. But the big story for me, I mean, talk about contempt for the truth, was that they never even mentioned that several, you know, possibly 1,000 pages, but certainly several hundred. We're not given a number. We were just told a substantial amount of data, all on Rendlesham, was missing. And they didn't even refer to it in passing. And, you know, to add insult to injury, they always have to bring in Roswell. And, you know, of course, in Britain, this thing is thought of as a big deal, but much like in America, where some people claim that a UFO landed in New Mexico in 1947. And, you know, with all of the wacky distortions about the Roswell incident, I've never heard anybody even, you know, refer to that possibility. It's always a crash.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just one more way to thumb your nose at, you know, even in their case, at the myth, legend, and lore, if they don't, you know, if they want to make believe that it didn't happen. But to say that it's allegations of a landing is beyond contempt. Way to go, New York Times. Keep it up.
Yeah, yeah. It's well, the whole thing with the files going missing, I mean, does anyone really believe that? I mean, I just presume that they just wouldn't release them. They just took them.
No. In fact, that was the big BBC story, that they were in somehow this batch of ones that had been cleared. Again, we're talking about what you and I would call mid-level or low-level files, maybe some interesting smoke, but certainly no smoking gun. No, you know, there's not going to be some disclosure-related event that's going to be triggered because of any of these documents. But the big story was, yes, these things were slated for release. They had been cleared, but they're missing. They're missing. And methinks the lady doth protest too much. It's so interesting the way that the power brokers continue to dance around this and evade and do their best to show us a shiny object. Oh, I noticed in today's New York Times, the Oxygen Network is going to bring back Paris Hilton for her new reality show where she has a miniature pony and a Bentley that's painted pink, and we get to watch her go to clubs and things. I mean, give me a break. But this is the America that we've grown into. Thank God, I'm sure some of these people in power say for Britney Spears and Charlie Sheen that they are the shiny objects or, you know, these Jersey Shore jerks. It's a little embarrassing and kind of enraging that we have so many people in this country who are so easily entertained by something beyond nonsense when, well, at the least, there's reruns of Law and Order. You can always get into those.
Well, you wonder how much is just they've had the fight beaten out of them in a sense. You know.
Well, I think that's a good point. And again, the ridicule factor, which I think is one of the most fascinating aspects of human behavior in the post-war years, is still alive and well and attaching itself to UFOs and unrelated subjects. Although, I think every year, another respectable tiny percentage of people crosses the line.
Yeah.
And they don't care, you know, what their friends and neighbors think about the fact that they take it seriously. That is a positive point, and I see it a little more every year here and in the UK especially. But we're still, you know, considerable distance from that critical mass.
Well, that brings me to sort of another big point that I did want to talk about with you, and it's sort of a nice natural segue into that. And that's just, you know, you've been interested in this for 30-plus years. And we did a year in review episode with Greg Bishop and Nick Redfern, and we all sort of had the same feeling in a sense that there's just I guess I call it the malaise, you know, this malaise right now where it feels like ufology is spinning its wheels a little bit. There hasn't been really anything to get excited about in a long time, and plus we're dealing with a lot of, you know, parties within ufology such as, you know, the disclosure crowd, let's say, you know, that are taking it in directions that aren't exactly what I think are best for the field in the long run. So it's like a double, you know, it's like the old school ufology sort of wavering or spinning its wheels and you know, this new generation or new party that's come along is also sort of problematic. So, I mean, how do you deal with the malaise, you know, because you have so much going on, you know, and you have so many different avenues and you write about so much different stuff. And every time I read new stuff from you, it's like an amazing new take on the different stuff. So it's like, how do you, you know, generate the interest? How do you keep it going?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Nick and Greg, I'm sorry I missed that show. You guys have, you know, you're such amazing individuals and come at this from three wonderfully unique directions. But I think that your take on it is correct. That's a good term to use. There's no sexy new monster case taking everybody's attention. The most important two books last year were appropriately, in my estimation, dry and academic as they should have been, but a very important one was the second installment of Rich Dolan's three-part series, UFOs in the National Security State. The other far and away was Leslie Keene's fine book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Speak Out. But it's not like there was another Intruders or, you know, another major new thing, the abduction phenomena. Yes, it's going on. And yes, last year, as far as I'm concerned, the two top people in the field were horribly and overwhelmingly irrationally attacked, in one case by somebody who David Jacobs was working with, who I consider a borderline personality. In the other case, Bud Hopkins' ex-wife. And, you know, there are a lot of what I would call ankle biters and people watching from the wings who say, oh, gosh, you know, maybe they are wrong. And so, you know, in certain circles, there's been a re-questioning of their methodology or, you know, their findings, et cetera. Bud is quite ill, so, you know, he's not been speaking out very much. As far as me personally, I just keep doing my work, and I try as much as possible to reach different audiences with different presentations. Friday, I'm heading up to Buffalo, New York for a weekend with Western New York MUFON. I'll be giving an investigators workshop for trained MUFON UFO investigators. But for me, I'm coming at it in a very personal way, starting with my my realization from what my dear sister Helen told me 35 years ago about her abduction experience, which blew my mind and changed my life. And although I read, you know, the MUFON Investigator's Handbook early on, I've never qualified. But I've learned a lot as an independent and doing crisis intervention work and traveling a lot and through my work as Bud's assistant for many years, certainly a lot of hands-on techniques, and a lot of it comes down to just being a decent person, a good listener, and giving people the respect that they need as they're going through what they're going through. But in the evening, we're going to take a look at that great sci-fi channel when it was the SCI. FI, as opposed to, you know, what it is now, that was made about Rendlesham. Give them a background on it. We'll watch it together. I've got a talk that I'll be doing on Wilhelm Reich's UFO-related work this summer for an international conference on Reich in Europe, a talk for a Tesla conference on Wilhelm Reich in Pennsylvania the second weekend of July. I'll be doing a talk on James Forrestal. I think part of it for me is just getting people through the door.
Yeah.
So I like to couch as much of it as possible in post-war American history and lay it on such a tightly woven timeline with real, kosher, above-board, genuine events and weave in the documents and the cover-up in a way that any really straight, extremely circumspect person can deal with. The other thing is, like you, working behind the scenes a bit to help local municipalities, that handful of them that have, you know, a right, a heritage to have an event, to help them, you know, get themselves up and running. It started for me with the McMinnville Festival, and when I first started working with them in Oregon in 2003. You and I now are very proud of our work with Exeter, New Hampshire for their September event, me with Roswell, and also this year joining the ranks is a tiny little town, you could blink as you go by it, it's about 2 hours north of Manhattan, called Pinebush. I knew it because when my sister Anne first started her first nursing job was at a little clinic there. But it's sort of like Bonnybridge, Scotland, in that it has the highest statistical confirmed analysis of sightings, anomalous events in the woods, multiply witnessed, you know, stuff in the sky of any community in New York State.
And oh,
they
wow.
had their yeah, they had their first one-day UFO festival and conference about 6 weeks ago, and it went quite well. So that's another thing. The other is to network with other folks in the field, to try not to, you know, get down about what you and Nick and Greg so well defined, because part of it is I'm one of the rare people who's crazy enough to actually be trying to make my living doing this, and of course, I'm a wonderful role model for descending into poverty. Not on, you know, not on food stamps. I'm living very nicely for where I am. But I'm only half joking. It's a terrible career, but it's important work, terrible career in terms of earnings.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really proud of the contributions I've made. I head into New York next week to do some work with the Sundance Channel, which for the first time,
oh, wow,
as far as I know, is putting together a an originally produced show, a documentary on this subject. And they have a wonderful track record. And every time that, you know, I get involved in something like that where I know, you know, somebody in the media is trying to buck the system and pull together something that is respectful, quality, letting the chips fall where they may, you know, it just picks me up and off I go, and it's a great feeling to be involved in something like that. But I'm not sure what it's going to take to get us out of this. MUFON, of course, is another thing. MUFON has been through all kinds of pandemonium the last less than a year, with accusations flying here and there, with people quitting, state section leaders being fired. You know, I feel for everybody, and, you know, hope that MUFON can straighten itself out and that the folks who have left from there continue with the great contributions they've made, either on their own or with new organizations or however you want to deal with it. I think one of the main things here, Tim, is when you're dealing with a subject that is so vilified, that is so distorted, that is so outsider, that is so important, that so many people in power want to go away, and that those of us that really lend our work, our attention, our intentions to, and some people burn out or move on to more practical, you know, aspects of life, and this becomes an avocation or a hobby, which I can certainly understand. For me, it's important work, and you do what you have to do to continue forward in it, even if it's treading water in a creative way. And, you know, you look at somebody like Nick Redfern. I'm proud to say I knew Nick before he wrote a book, and now he's written 187
of them. Yeah.
And they're all terrific. I love the guy, and he's a wonderful presenter and a very gutsy researcher who gets in between the lines, crosses over into paranormal, cryptozoology, will really look hard at and write a book at something that's considered an unpopular theory. Like, did Roswell really happen, or was it a series of other events that made people believe it was? That went over really big in Roswell when I heard him speak on that a couple of years ago.
I'm sure, yeah.
And you know what? I just was so impressed because that is the kind of intellectual curiosity and drive, I think, that makes people talk and think and move forward in this field. You know, Greg, as a great paranormalist, a raconteur, a rational skeptic, you know, he's just another wonderful asset. You know, you are now a regular fixture around the world with your radio show in this amazing era of internet radio, where anybody like you who develops an audience, you know, it just keeps expanding, maybe not geometrically, but arithmetically. And more people listen. There's good word of mouth. It's amazing what you can do with guerrilla promotion or self-promotion right now. And when all fails, you know, or is said and done for me, I am one of those people who have, you know, a whole bunch of other passionate interests, whether it's photography or history or theater or architecture. I was lucky enough to get away to Canada about 2 weeks ago and spent a week in Stratford, which is probably the largest concentration of actors living in one town in North America.
Oh, wow.
And it's filled with theaters, and two-thirds of the year, it's just alive with activity. And my friends and I went to see two plays, one an adaptation of John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, and the other, The Merry Wives of Windsor, one of the few Shakespeare plays I had not seen. And dig this, about 10 minutes before curtain, I'm going through the program, huge theater in like two-thirds.
Yeah.
I see that the lead, character named Falstaff is played by a marvelous Canadian actor who's an old friend of mine who I managed to play for in New York 6 years ago.
Oh, weird.
And he was sensational. I was waiting for him at the stage door. It was a great reunion. And one of the first things he said is, you know, your book is on my shelf, which I thought was wonderful because, you know, he obviously hadn't read it, but he didn't want me to think he had forgotten about it or something, and he was too honest to say anything else, but it was just very sweet. Anyway, you know, life is a very rich thing, and for anybody that is just involved in UFOs, God help you.
I know, yeah.
You will go insane. You will lose your mind. It's very important to be able to bounce off your own walls and, you know, have a good time and, you know, just get in there and have fun.
Yeah.
And lighten the hell up sometimes, because this stuff sometimes makes you feel like you're carrying around the weight of the world.
Exactly.
That is not the way it should be.
Exactly. Yeah, that's something we've talked about a lot on the show, is that need to have other interests and not take this too seriously, because, you know, a lot of great people have dedicated their lives and come and gone and didn't get any answers. So
it's true, and we will or we won't. And as far as the disclosure movement goes and exopolitics, I think overall we have a lot of good people, especially in Europe, which we don't hear about that much here, who have formed these kind of activist groups where they put on their own conferences where, you know, if they're overzealous, maybe better that than, you know, not being involved at all, where their aim is to begin to educate government officials and the public at large, and more power to them. I think the notion that had been pushed for some time here, that especially when President Obama was coming into office, that because, you know, one of his key advisors was John Podesta, who we know was on record as taking the subject of excessive UFO secrecy seriously, that disclosure was, you know, 3.5 days away, and of course that was nonsense. But at the same time, I understand the positive impulse to try to break through this in that way. I just don't feel that it's going to happen, certainly not quite yet. And in a funny way, I think Rich Dolan nailed it down in a way when asked, "What do you think disclosure is going to happen with our government?" And he said words to the effect of, "I don't think the United States government," and I'm very much paraphrasing here for just listening, "I don't think the United States government is ever going to willingly, you know, declassify and disclose what it has about this subject, but I think disclosure is inevitable." And I think what he meant by that, and the way that I feel more and more the past few years that we've seen phenomena like, although it is quite unique on its own, WikiLeaks. You know, I think about when I was younger and Daniel Ellsberg released this tremendous amount of information on the Vietnam War, and it was a tremendous embarrassment to the government, but it did change things to some degree. And perhaps, you know, this, if they don't kill Julian Assange or lock him away in a tiny dungeon for the rest of his life, that he will most certainly, they have released some UFO information, but it's not out of the question that it may come that way. Who knows? Maybe it'll come at us through an unknown source and just somebody will dump it onto the internet.
Yeah.
Then there are, of course, the wild cards of them. If they ever want us to know that they are here en masse, as opposed to, you know, a few people at a time in sightings or abductions, all they have to do is, one of my favorite science fiction scenarios, the beginning of V, the original tacky made-for-TV miniseries and the kind of creepy remake of it. But I must say, as science fiction, you know, alien-related premises go, I thought it was one of the great kick-ass starts of anything. It's up there with Jules Verne or H.G. Wells or Gene Roddenberry, simply that, you know, 60 honking huge motherships pull in over the 60 biggest cities in the world, and they just hang there for a couple of months. Game over. And then, of course, it degenerates into every World War II resistance movie I've ever seen in my life, except that instead of Nazis, it's, you know, these male and female modelly looking aliens here to cure cancer, but really they take off their plastic skins and they're reptiles who eat us and mice and are not here for good purposes. It could change at any moment.
Right.
Or, you know, it could change not at all, or years from now, or decades, or in a year. It keeps it interesting. But again, I think most of our friends are sleepwalking their way through this. We're not conspiracists. We're not conspiracy theorists. We're not, you know, strange people. We just are onto something that a lot of people either don't have the time or are not comfortable, and God knows who is, looking into and are doing flighty, inconsequential things like paying their bills, raising healthy children, you know, working and keeping their mortgages up. And, of course, I'm being sarcastic here. These are the most important things in life for most people, and more power to them. And this, you know, the fact that we do this shouldn't change goals like, you know, having a business or falling in love or getting into a great relationship or, you know, doing other things that make a difference in the world or in our own little worlds. So that's the long answer to your short question.
No, that was perfect. I mean, yeah, you nailed a lot of things that are key here. And, you know, I think listening to you just now, it just struck me too that in a way, and maybe I didn't consider this, although I've been kind of thinking this over the past few weeks myself.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate in a way that we can pursue this, because there's a lot of people that I talk to people, I run into people that you tell them what you do, you tell them, you know, this field that we're in, and then, you know, their eyes light up and they're interested in this subject.
It is,
they don't have the wherewithal or the time to pursue it.
Well, the fact is we sacrifice quite a bit to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The security of a regular job or living a more straight out kind of life, but we made these choices. Nobody forced us to do it. And I think you're right. Through the miracle of Facebook, which I joined initially last year to primarily be more accessible to readers and people who have heard me on great shows like yours or seen me on television or heard me speak at a conference. And it's been very gratifying to have so many folks in that category jump into my life and ask questions or occasionally just check in or say hi or, study the thing more. But the biggest kick for me has been people that have come out of the woodwork of my past, whether it was when I was at the University of Bridgeport 1,000 years ago or a student at the School of Visual Arts, or I was back and forth this morning twice with a woman who is now married and has grown up kids, but I still remember her as this cute little girl with a bowl haircut that sat near me in the first grade. And I haven't seen her in, you know, more years than I want to say,
yeah.
But we're still friends and we go back and forth every couple of weeks. I did a talk at ARE, the Edgar Cayce Foundation's headquarters in New York City, where they occasionally have UFO speakers, about 6 weeks ago. And one of my best buddies from high school showed up, and I hadn't seen him since, like, the 60s. And he's a doctor now, and he brought his wife and son. And it was so much fun and so exciting and so touching. And, you know, it's like, wow, I can't believe you're doing this, man. It's like, wow, I can't believe you became a doctor.
Yeah.
So, you know, as Sonny and Cher used to say, the beat goes on.
Exactly, yeah. Now, here's something that I'd be interested in getting your perspective on. Not necessarily, you know, what you think is going to happen and all that foolishness, but this whole 2012 thing. I mean,
oh God,
it's building up. And I've warned people, and I was out having drinks with a buddy of mine who's interested in the field to a degree around, I think it was the day before the big rapture a few weeks ago.
Well. That was, of course, the before and after of all our lives, and I was amazing watching the 400,000 most devout Christians ascend to heaven, and of course, you know, have all the demons poking us with pitchforks now, although it doesn't feel much different than it did before the rapture.
No, no. But I was saying to him, you know, I watched a lot of, surprisingly got a lot of coverage on the TV. I thought it was this little sort of esoteric thing that not too many people knew about. And, of course, multiply that times like 100, it's going to be 2012. Yeah. And I said, you know, the joke's on us here in the field, in a sense, because they're not laughing with us. They're laughing at us, even if we don't believe in the 2012 thing.
Yeah. Well, I think you brought up several very important points, Tim. Number one, with all due respect to anyone's and everyone's religious beliefs, my feelings, the way that I was brought up in a Reformed Jewish family, to understand that the Old Testament is not just true stories related from ancient times, that it was earlier myths, analogies, allegories, morality lessons, fables with a lesson attached to them, and that the idea of prophecy and justifying everything based on it being written down is something that fundamentalist religious thinkers follow. Fundamentalism, by the way, extends across the world of every religion, and it simply refers to completely rigid thinking that things are exactly the way that you interpret them or your leaders interpret them. There is no room for any kind of interpretation. It is just the way it is. And I have gone nose to nose with more fundamentalist Christian UFO researchers than anybody in ufology, as far as I know. And there I have put out a standing invitation to go one-on-one or two-on-one or whatever with any of those folks that want to go on stage with me. You know, I don't know scripture as well as they do, but prophecy rarely, I mean, I don't remember the last time where, you know, some major prediction relative to, you know, somebody's religious beliefs came to pass on this earth. And frankly, the fact that the folks out there, especially in the media, of, oh, you're into UFOs, well, you must be interested in ghosts too and reincarnation and 2012. Well, maybe, yeah. But the point is, to lump it all together is not just muddying the waters. It's condescending. It's insulting. It's a way of demeaning, you know, the serious work that we do. But, you know, so much of 2012 prophecy is based on the Mayan calendar. Not that I know anyone that is fluent in Mayan. They just dig all this pop culture stuff that it's going to be the end of the world.
Yeah.
I think that there's a slight misinterpretation there. I think that the Mayan calendar suggests that in 2012, correct or not, we'll find out, there will be a shift in universal thinking or something that will not end life on Earth, will in fact, you know, cause a change of some sort in our perception of ourselves. And, or that they may have simply done the math not quite right, and, you know, the same way that these jerks, and I don't know what else to say, that put forward that the ascension into heaven, that the end times were upon us 2.5 weeks ago, this primarily came from a multimillionaire evangelical radio host who sat down and did a lot of math and said that, you know, it was going to happen 2.5 weeks ago. And what really got to me was a few days before, I was listening to National Public Radio, as I sometimes do, and they were doing a series of interviews with folks who were taking this very seriously, fundamentalist Christian people, who were certainly decent, hardworking, I would hope kind, you know, life-affirmative folks, living their lives, working their jobs, paying their mortgages, raising their kids, who were so convinced it was going to happen, Tim, that they had quit their jobs. They were spending their savings. They were just reading scripture and spending time with their family, waiting to either ascend to heaven or to be left behind, as they say. And they're in even more financial trouble now than they were.
Right.
This, to me, is unconscionable. And it, you know, it's the thing that really gets to me the most. But I think it's absolute nonsense. And I would bet you dollars to donuts there will be people, a tiny handful, even if it's one, who at some point after we're not all destroyed in flaming cataclysm in a year and a half or so, will actually be going to court and using as a defense for having to default on a loan or something that, Your Honor, you know, I thought it was the end of the world. So, I was just acting according to what my religious philosophy dictates. Mark my words, there's going to be some puff piece on the news about it. And I'm not trying to make fun of these people. I think it's tragic. It is so easy to mislead people, and more we're seeing it with our leaders who are more and more under the influence of corporatists and people who are just moving the money around from folks who used to be middle class, who are now more and more in the serf category,
yeah,
to the super, super rich, and making believe it's about safety and patriotism and freedom and all of this crap. And those things are not crap, but the illusion that they're perpetrating on the American public is unconscionable. It's treasonous as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, these people should be writ out of town on a rail, as they say. But I don't know what we do to stop it. We, the people, are getting railroaded. And it's no different in the world of UFO studies, where for every quality contribution, and again, I point back to, say, Leslie Keene's fine book last year, there are going to be folks in positions of tremendous power that are going to be biting the ankles of people like Leslie or looking to take them down overtly or covertly or innuendo or suggestion. And the newest kind of example of this in opposite form is a book that came out really about 3 weeks ago or so by a writer with the Los Angeles Times, a technology correspondent, as I recall, named Jacobson, and it's a book on the history of Area 51.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, her sources have let her know in no uncertain terms, and of course they're quality sources, and she went with them, that all this UFO stuff is nonsense, and, you know, it has nothing to do with the history of this highly classified test range and military facility in Nevada, which, by the way, is bigger than Holland. I've been as close as you can get without getting shot at it. And it's just beyond belief how large it is, although out west, you know, spaces go on and on. And that book is probably a good book in other respects, but it will help perpetrate the myth that, you know, this whole UFO thing, and right now in terms of black technology, whether it's back engineering or what have you, is nonsense, and certainly any association with other intelligence, highly advanced craft, and that mythical base, that not mythical, that legendary base, you know, scholars, thinkers, people with degrees, folks who take themselves seriously, going to read the book. And, well, it's in the book, so, you know, she wouldn't have gotten that wrong. She's a smart, well-connected reporter. And so the mind will continue to reinforce itself around that misnomer.
Pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Lobontoni. Some people believe the world will come to an end tomorrow. What are you going to do between now and then?
I'm Tony Kornheiser. Eat something I've never tried before, like a hamster.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
But have you seen Facebook ever in your life?
No, I haven't.
You might want to take a look.
I used to see Redbook when I went to beauty parlors
yeah,
with my mom.
I'm sure.
That's a long
time
ago.
Well, this is about as harmless as that.